Pull up a chair. 72 years ago today, on a warm morning in Burbank, California, a big, homely, slab-sided airplane lifted off the runway at the Lockheed plant and pointed its nose toward the desert. Nobody in the crowd that day would have called it beautiful. It had a fat belly. It sat up high on tall, ungainly landing gear like a farm dog that had grown into its legs but not its coordination. Four big paddle-bladed propellers hung off a straight, high wing. And here's the thing, that airplane is still in production today. This is Radio Hangar. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is The Hangar, where we tell the stories behind the machines. And today, on August 23rd, we are going to talk about the airplane that first flew on this very date in 1954. The Lockheed C-130 Hercules, the Herc, the one they said would never work, the one of the greatest aircraft designers who ever lived swore would destroy the whole company. Let me tell you how wrong he was. Now, before we get rolling, a quick word about the folks who help keep this hangar door open. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins for every milestone in flight. Your first solo, your private pilot certificate, your instrument rating all the way up the ladder. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. And I know a few of you have got a drawer full of stories already. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. All right, let's set the scene. It's 1951, the Korean War is on, and the United States Air Force is learning a hard lesson that it should have already known from the last war. Its cargo airplanes are not good enough. The transports they had were mostly leftovers and hand-me-downs, aircraft designed before or during the Second World War. Airplanes with piston engines that guzzled avgas, with cabins you loaded through a side door about waist high, so you needed ramps and ladders and a whole lot of sweat to get a Jeep or a howitzer inside. And they couldn't get into the rough, short dirt strips where the soldiers actually needed the supplies. So the Air Force wrote up a requirement, and it was an ambitious one for the time.
They wanted an airplane that could carry 90 fully equipped troops, or a stack of cargo over roughly 2,000 miles. They wanted it to fly slow enough to drop paratroopers and low enough to drop supplies. They wanted it to operate out of short, unpaved fields, dirt, grass, sand, and they wanted it to be able to keep flying if one engine quit on takeoff. They sent that requirement out to the Airplane Builders of America, and one of the companies that got a copy was Lockheed. Now here's where it gets interesting. Lockheed handed the study over to a designer named Willis Hawkins and his team, and they did something a little radical. Instead of starting with a pretty airplane and figuring out how to stuff cargo into it, they started with the cargo and built the airplane around it. Think about that. Every design decision flowed from one question. How do you get heavy, awkward loads in and out of this thing, fast, in a place with no equipment? So they gave it a cargo floor that sat at truck bed height, back a deuce and a half up to it and roll the load straight across. They put a ramp in the tail, so you could drive a vehicle right up into the belly, or open it in flight and push pallets out the back into the slipstream. They set the wing up high on top of the fuselage, so the cargo box underneath was clean and unobstructed and close to the ground, and they hung four of the new turboprop engines on it. The Allison T-56, that was the gamble. Turbine engines spinning propellers. More power, more reliability, and the ability to run on jet fuel instead of high-octane gasoline. This was cutting edge in 1951. Turbine power was brand new and not entirely trusted. They built it tough. Landing gear like tree trunks. Structure you could abuse. An airplane that expected to be treated badly and kept coming back for more. And it was, let's be honest, kind of ugly. Which brings us to the part of the story I love the most.
At Lockheed in those days, there was a man named Clarence Johnson. Everybody called him Kelly. And Kelly Johnson was not just any engineer. This is the man who would go on to run the Skunk Works. The man behind the P-38 Lightning, the man behind the U-2 spy plane, and later the ASR-71 Blackbird, the fastest airplane the world has ever known. When Kelly Johnson had an opinion about an airplane, people listened, because the man was almost never wrong. And Kelly Johnson looked at the design for this fat, slow, straight-winged cargo hauler, and he hated it. The story goes that when he was asked to sign the proposal to send to the Air Force, he said words to the effect of, "If you sign that document, you will destroy the Lockheed Company." Now think about that for a second. One of the most brilliant aeronautical minds in history looked at what would become the most successful military transport airplane ever built, and he thought it was a career-ending mistake. Why? Because Kelly Johnson thought in terms of speed and altitude and grace. His airplanes cut through the sky like knives, and this Hercules, well, it was a truck, a flying truck. It wasn't fast. It wasn't sleek, it didn't set any records for going high or going quick. But that was exactly the point.
The Air Force didn't need another knife, they needed a workhorse, they needed a mule that would carry the load into the hard places and not complain. Lockheed signed the proposal anyway, they won the contract, and they built two prototypes, which brings us to this morning, 72 years ago, August 23, 1954, Burbank, California. In the cockpit sat two test pilots, Stanley Belts and Roy Wimmer, behind them, a small crew of flight test engineers watching gauges ready to write down every number and every shutter. Picture the moment. Those four Allison turboprops spinning up with that distinctive turbine whine, a sound that anybody who's ever stood on a ramp near a Herc knows in their bones. Not the deep pistons rumble of the old transports, something higher, smoother, hungrier. They ran the engines up, they released the brakes, and that homely airplane, the one Kelly Johnson swore would ruin them all, gathered itself up and rolled down the runway at Burbank. And it flew. There's a story that's been told about that first flight, and I'll pass it along the way I heard it, the way hangar stories get told. They had a chase plane up to watch the prototype, keep an eye on it, be ready to call out anything that looked wrong, and that chase plane was a P-2V Neptune, a patrol bomber, a genuinely capable airplane in its own right, and the brand new cargo hauler. This flying truck that nobody thought much of reportedly flew so well and climbed so strong that the chase plane had trouble staying with it. That's how the Hercules introduced itself to the world. Out of Burbank, up over the California scrub, and off toward Edwards Air Force Base in the desert, a clean, honest first flight for an airplane that would go on to fly, in one form or another, for the next seven decades and counting. Let that settle in for a minute. Let me put that in perspective for you. The C-130 first flew in 1954. That's the same era as poodle skirts and drive-in movies. Eisenhower was in the White House. Most of the airliners of the day still had piston engines and propellers. The jet age for the traveling public hadn't really arrived yet. And that airplane, that same basic design, is still rolling off the production line in Marietta, Georgia, today. Not a museum piece, not a restoration. A current, in-production, frontline airplane, it holds the record as the longest continuous military aircraft production run in history. Grandfathers flew it, their sons flew it, now their grandkids are flying it, same airplane, same silhouette against the sky. Now, part of why it's lasted is that the Hercules turned out to be one of the most adaptable airframes ever conceived. That big, empty, boxy fuselage, the very thing that made it ugly, made it endlessly useful. You could put anything in there, and people did. They made it a gunship. The AC-130, take that cargo hauler, cut gun ports in the left side, load it up with cannon, and have it circle over a target at night, pouring fire down in a slow, deadly pylon turn. The cargo mule became one of the most feared close air support platforms in the world. They made it a tanker, trailing hoses to refuel other airplanes and helicopters in midair. They put skis on it, the LC-130, and they flew it to the bottom of the world, landing on the ice in Antarctica and up in Greenland, supplying research stations in places where nothing else could get in. They sent it into hurricanes on purpose. The weather folks fly a version right into the eye of the storm, gathering the data that tells us where the thing is going and how hard it's going to hit. While the rest of us are boarding up windows, there's a Herc crew flying into the worst weather on the planet, on purpose because that's the airplane you trust to bring you back out. They fought wildfires with it, dumping retardant on the ridgelines. And here's one a lot of you have seen with your own eyes. If you've ever been to an air show and watched the Blue Angels, you've seen their support airplane. The C-130 they call Fat Albert. It flies its own demonstration, and to hear that big Herc come roaring down the show line low and loud, you understand real quick that this truck can dance when it wants to. There's one more feat I have to mention, because pilots don't believe it until they hear it twice. Back in 1963, the Navy wanted to know if you could operate a Hercules off of an aircraft carrier. Not a catapult launch, not an arresting wire, just fly it aboard and fly it off. On that short little deck out in the Atlantic, in a great big four-engine transport that was never, ever designed to go anywhere near a ship, and they did it. A crew took a Herc out to the carrier and made a whole series of landings and takeoffs on the deck, fully loaded on some of them, without a tailhook and without a catapult. To this day, the C-130 is the largest and heaviest airplane ever to land on an aircraft carrier. They decided it was too risky to make it routine, but they proved it could be done in a cargo plane, on a boat. Now here's what I want you to take away from all this. The airplane that made history was not the pretty one. It was not the fast one. It was not the one the genius wanted to build. Kelly Johnson was a great man and a great engineer, and I mean no disrespect to his memory, because Lord knows he earned his place among the immortals. But he was flat wrong about the Hercules. and I think the reason he was wrong is worth chewing on, because it's a lesson that goes way beyond airplanes. He judged that airplane by how it looked and how it performed on the numbers that mattered to him: speed, altitude, elegance, and by those numbers, the Herc was nothing special. But the people who designed it weren't chasing those numbers, they were solving a real problem for real people in real places. How do you get the beans and the bullets and the wounded soldiers in and out of a dirt strip in the middle of nowhere? And when you build an honest airplane to solve an honest problem, and you build it tough enough to take a beating, you end up with something that outlasts every sleek and clever thing around it. There's a lesson in there for those of us who fly, too. We get seduced by the glass panels and the composite curves and the speed numbers in the ads, and those things are wonderful, but the airplanes that earn our love over a lifetime are usually the honest ones, the ones that do the job, the ones that bring you home. The Hercules is the ultimate honest airplane, 72 years old today and still going to work every single morning, all over the world, in places that don't have a paved runway or a control tower or a soul who knows how to fix it. And it just keeps flying, grumpy old thing, loud, not much to look at. I love it to pieces. My thanks to the good people at Lockheed Martin for keeping the history of this airplane, and to the aviation historians and the Air Force records that keep the details of that first flight in 1954 alive for the rest of us. If you want more hangar stories like this one, you know where to find us. RadioHangar.com. So the next time you hear that turbine whine and you look up and see that fat, high-winged silhouette lumbering across the sky, tip your hat to it. That's the ugly duckling that never turned into a swan and never needed to. This is Taildragger. Keep the greasy side down, and I'll see you next time.